Welcome to Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release, a podcast dedicated to licensed wildlife rehabilitators and the veterinarians who support them. I'm your host, Gail Buell.
Techniques we discuss here are meant for licensed wildlife professionals. If you aren't licensed and trained for wildlife rehabilitation, do not attempt to capture, hold, or rehabilitate any wild animal. If you find an injured wild animal, a wildlife professional can recommend next steps. We will tackle topics about rescue, care, management, reconditioning, and releasing wildlife found in North America. This is a deep dive into each subject. We hope to give rehabilitators information they can use because they're already going to great lengths to rescue and nurse animals back to health. There are three possible outcomes in wildlife rehabilitation: release, euthanasia, and placement. An injured or orphaned wild animal's journey to restored health and independence in their natural habitat is delicate and complex. We draw techniques and expertise from many disciplines. Many animals brought into rehabilitation cannot be saved. The last gift we can give them is humane euthanasia. We'll talk more about when this is necessary. Sometimes animals are deemed non-releasable and evaluated to be suitable for a life in captivity. When that happens, we shift to a long-term approach to managing their care, training, and housing. Some such animals serve as ambassador animals, a term for animals that rehabilitators use to educate the public. Each episode, we'll speak with experts who represent specialty topics across the profession of wildlife rehabilitation, ambassador animal care and management, showcasing best practices.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. We return with Tim Jasinski for part two of our discussion on fostering Canada geese. Be sure to catch up on episode 5 if you missed it. Tim and I talked about his origin story, natural history of the Canada goose, and some pros and cons of fostering goslings. Now, we continue the conversation on goose behavior. Later, we get into all the factors in fostering, and also more on goose growth and development. So let's jump right in that pond. So some of the behaviors that the adult geese show are defensive, right? We're defending the chicks. I'm defending my territory, that kind of thing. What do those behaviors generally look like? And do they have an order of which they exhibit those behaviors?
They do, actually. So, and there's different variables. So it's not always easy because there's some pairs that are very territorial and will not allow any other birds on that pond for mm-hmm. the whole season. Mm-hmm. And there's others that are tolerant of other pairs within their territory, but on the edges of the territory.
Okay.
Or they're just used to that situation. So typically in an ideal situation where you're going to foster, when you're fostering Canada geese, the ideal scenario is you have a location with multiple families. That's the best case, which we'll talk about later.
Okay.
But you'll have certain situations where you have just one pair of geese on one pond, no other geese around. That may be just a very, very, a territorial pair. I remember when I was a kid in the 90s at Tri-C College, I would go up there and look at the geese and ducks every year. There was one pair on these three little finger lakes there in the campus in Parma. And that bird was so territorial. I watched him fend off a red-tailed hawk, like probably 200 yards away from the pond itself.
Wow.
He flew up at that hawk in the midair over the road and chased that hawk out of the territory. And
wow.
I never forgot that. And so that bird, they nested in the same exact location under this little tree at the edge of the mm-hmm. pond. The female had a little bit more white on her cheek, and I knew who was her. And by his behavior, I knew it was him. And they never let any other goose on that pond ever. Other than that pair of their babies. But other, like one of our main fostering spots here on a private residence in the area, there's multiple families, but they'll nest farther away on the same property.
Okay.
And they'll go to the pond and they have a certain area that they're allowed to be on. And so there's tolerance there. So
okay.
it can vary on pond to pond, but typically what I've seen in any situation is when the goslings hatch, the parents are very, very, very territorial with any other geese within that first week of the babies being alive and moving around. They're really tall, they're really small, they're really vulnerable to predators, and so they're very alert and very, very mm-hmm. aware of their surroundings, very territorial within that first week of life with those kids.
How is that exhibited? I mean, you explained the one, which was in a whoa extreme case, but do they hiss first? Do they lower their head, neck out, and wings out? But then they run forward, then they fly at the other one. What do they do?
They do. So typically the first behavior you'll see when you have, say you have a pair of geese that have babies or a nest, but let's just say babies, and you have another pair on the other side of the pond, and they're kind of walking near that pair with goslings. The first behavior that I remember that I can think of noticing is they'll fluff their wing feathers out. And that's a, I'm mad, you better pay attention and back off. And so geese know this behavior. Many people don't, but right. Geese know that as a, you know, hey, you better back up, I'm uncomfortable.
And the noise and then, you made, is that from the wings or their voice?
It's from their wings. Yeah, wings. The wings fluffed it, and it kind of fluffs up, and you know, kind of like with the hawk rousing on the glove. It's kind of like that, but it's more of a direct kind of. It's meant to show, hey, I'm uncomfortable here. Okay. I don't like this. I don't like you coming near me. Mm-hmm. So they'll do that, and then if the bird doesn't listen, they will. The male and female will lower their heads in aggressive posture. So they'll head pump, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but then they kind of keep their head down for a second. They'll have it down low. And if they become really, really like about to explode and run, as you said, their head's going to be low. Basically their chin is going to be horizontal with the ground. Their head's going to be down along the ground, and they're going to put their head out, and they're going to run straight at the target that they're trying to chase away, whether it's another goose or humans or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's a back off, I'm uncomfortable. And then they'll fluff their wings again, then they'll walk back to their female. Mm-hmm. This is the male that's typically doing that. And then they kind of go back, and he'll head pump with the female, basically saying like, hey, I'm here. You know, I got you. I'm comfortable. I'm taking care of you. And then he'll, you know, look over at that target and basically say like, hey, you know, you better back up. So, and it's hard to do this over an audio kind of.
Yes,
you know?
It is.
And so I'm going to do a fostering videos. When next time I do a fostering class, I'm going to get videos put together, because I have videos of all this, and really show the details and pause and explain what's going on. So it may be a little bit harder through a podcast to see that. But if you know goose behavior and you're a rehabilitator, all these make sense to you. It just, it may not have, it, this podcast might put it all together like, oh, that's what I need to do. Or that's how I figure
right,
it out.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so it's really interesting, you know, watching these behaviors. And so that's kind of the situation you get into with the aggression with the pairs.
So then, well, let's just go into goslings. Now, why do goslings come into care?
So that's a really good question. And I don't know fully why exactly, but one of the reasons that we're running into more often now is the companies that are running the geese with the dogs. Mm-hmm. Part of their process is to separate the babies from the parents to stress them, so they'll go somewhere else. And as you know, like, where else are they really going to go? And so in these processes, sometimes the babies scoot away and get lost. That's one reason. Another reason, I just think that they travel around and they get lost. The babies walk around. They're like, oh, this grass looks tasty. And they kind of walk around and they get lost, and they just get lost. It just, you know, it just happens. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know exactly. It makes more sense with mallards or other ducks, because they're walking so far and there's so many obstacles they have to cross, like sewers and roads and fences and things like that. But with geese, it is tricky, and we do get a fair amount every year. So I don't know. They're just found alone, and maybe they're just a little bit too, probably the main reasons are a little bit too weak to keep up. Maybe they're the last egg laid or the last to hatch, or maybe they just, you know, just not all animals are meant to survive. So that could be it too. I'm not really sure, but we certainly get a handful, more than a handful every year that are found alone.
Right. And you're getting them at different stages of being a gosling too?
Most of the time we're getting them within their first week of life. Usually the first day after they hatch is when we typically get most of them. Mm-hmm. We will get some that are older, but usually by then they're pretty much, they learn the territory, they learn where they're at, they learn the routes. Mm-hmm. And so they might be a little bit harder to catch from the public. But typically you're getting them in that first week or less when they're, you know, when they hatch. That's typically where you're getting them the most.
Mm-hmm. Okay. when you get them into care, and you know, we do all the typical things for rehab, right? We're, you know, give them a chance to warm up and de-stress a little bit, and then give them an exam, that kind of thing. But you, before we get into the fostering, which is the next big topic, is how do you set up an enclosure for them? We know it's going to be temporary because you're going to foster them, but what does it look like?
So it depends, you know, for us here, we've evolved our protocols over the years, trying to make things better. And we've learned from the past, and making things better really, you know, really changes. And as you know, as a rehabilitator, or any animal care, you know, you always want to better what you do for these animals, mm-hmm. to have better success, whether it's breeding endangered species or, you know, in captive, you know, collections or whatever it is, you know, the better you could do for that animal, the better chance they have. And so we're always striving for that as rehabilitators. And so typically I'll give you a little bit of background on what we did in the past, and then mm-hmm. kind of how we've evolved and changed. So in the past, we would get, you know, young geese in, they were orphaned, and we would put them with mallards, which is okay if they're around the same age, not too aggressive with the babies, because certain sure. goslings can be actually pretty aggressive. So mm-hmm. it's better that they're with other waterfowl versus just alone, because they're going to peep all day long and they're going to want to chase you around. And right. like we had talked before, when Canada geese hatch, the first thing they see are their parents, and they imprint on those parents. So like we talked about it before with imprinting, it's an innate instinctive process that says, oh, those are my parents. This is what I need to do for the rest of my life, is I need to be a goose and learn and how to be a goose. And so they hatch and they see their parents. And so that's what they learn from. They follow, you know, like there was, what was that man that raised the, was it the whooping cranes or the trumpeters?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Reintroduction. Cranes. You know, mm-hmm. they followed an airplane to migrate. And so he imprinted them on that airplane, and they learned to follow the airplane, and that's how they learned their migration route. And that's really impressive stuff. And so they learn their parents, they know. And so when they're in captivity, you don't want them to think that's us. And so even though they were imprinted on their parents, they habituate and imprint on us really quickly. And Canada geese are very, very fast at doing that. So generally, they're so adorable. I mean, we've all seen baby geese. They're so cute.
They are.
And it's so hard for a little kid that finds one to take it home, and his parents to say, nope, we're taking it to a rehab center. They want to take care of it for a couple of days, maybe even a week, maybe 2 weeks. And the poop starts happening larger and more frequent. And they're like, well, we need to get this bird to a rehab center. And then by that time, it's already done a lot of damage. It could be reversed, and there's a lot, we could talk about that too, but it's not easy. And the older the bird, the less likely you are to get that bird released. Because
right, yeah, because if they've habituated to being fed and all that kind of stuff at that impressionable age, why would they think anything different? And if they get to a point in the wild where it's like they're hungry or something like that, and in the past food came from humans, they're gonna walk right up to people.
Yep. And that's not good for many reasons.
So
what we used to do in the past is they would go into an enclosure with a heat lamp, you know, with by themselves, they would peep and they would peep and they would peep. And then we would open the cage to give them water or something. Then it would boop, boop, boop. They'd do the little whistles that they do. And that's a comfort thing. And that's like, oh, hey, hey, dad, hey, mom, hey, hey, you're here. I'm happy. That's not good, because you don't want that bird peeping at you, because that means it's comfort with you and habituated with you. And that's not good. So what we started using is mirrors. We throw mirrors in there, and then they can kind of help, you know, we'll just say imprinting, habituation, whatever we want to call it, on themselves. So that's better than us. And so we would keep them in a separate room away from people. But, you know, as our centers were moving around, we have animals everywhere. And so it's kind of hard to keep them in one area alone by themselves without hearing us. So then we would foster them, and we would take them in a box, take them to a location and let them go. And they would follow us right back to the car every time. And so I'm like, well, this ain't working. You know, the parents wanted them, but the babies were not, it wasn't working. So then we started using the mirrors and scaring them. And that it sounds horrible, and it is. It's not fun to scare them, but it really increased the chances of them being more likely to go to a foster family versus having, coming back to us and following us back to the car. So we would shake a can of pennies in one of those old metal Folgers cans. If you remember when we were kids, mm-hmm. the yep. metal cans, you'd shake that, you know, when you'd open the enclosure. So it would give them that stimulus of, oh crap, there's a loud noise when they open that. When I see a human, that's bad. And so mm-hmm. It's sad. And, you know, it's not fun for the volunteers or the interns, but we always really say like, this is the reason why this is so important on why we do this. It's not fun. I don't like doing it. But it improves that chance of that bird getting back out there into the wild where it belongs, where we want it to be. And it's so crucial that we do that. So that's why we do it. And so that helped immensely. But then another thing that really helped is using decoys. I started using one of my buddies is a big goose waterfowl hunter. And I'm not against mm-hmm. hunting. You know, I'm just yep. not a hunter myself for obvious mm-hmm. reasons, but mm-hmm. I'm not against it. You know, a lot of that money that they put into their ammunition and their licenses goes to conservation. I'm mm-hmm. obviously all for mm-hmm. that, for not just geese and waterfowl, but all species that need that habitat. So totally okay with that, but I just can't do it myself. It's just better that way. So we have found that when we did that, we started using kennels to release the birds in versus a box, because a box, you have to take them out of the box and set them on the ground. Then the parents see you touching the bird. The bird sees you, and it's a confusing thing. So we started using kennels. Mm-hmm. You know, like we'd release a screech owl or a kestrel, we'd have the kennel in there with a towel over it, open the door and back up and get out of there. Run. I'd run away, run to the other side right. of the pond and get away. Okay. And then that baby is going to, you know, because it's by itself, it's going to be peeping and peeping and peeping. And that gander is going to instantly rush over to that kennel because of that. That's a dad, mm-hmm. I'm scared kind of sound. And those sure. parents, the instincts take over and they run over and they accept that baby. And we'll talk different intricates about how to know if that's going to work or not, and how to do that properly. But that's kind of the quick way of what we changed in the past. And we started using decoys, and they.
So you just put the decoys right in the enclosure with the
enclosure. Yep. Okay. And we use these full body decoys to kind of move in the wind. So it kind of looks like they're feeding or they're moving, and that keeps it, you know, cause I've tried to foster youngsters in the past before we did the decoys, and they were scared of geese. They were terrified of that mm-hmm. bird, even though they hatched underneath one, they were right. terrified of it. So once mm-hmm. I started using decoys, they recognized that look, that color, that shape, the size. And when I go into the enclosure and I clap my hands, they all rush underneath the decoys and hide. Sure. And that means our job has been done and done correctly. And if their other conditions are ready, they're ready for release. And so mm-hmm. Ready for fostering.
Right.
And so.
And you just mentioned something that I hope everybody caught, because we at first were talking about a single gosling. And then at the end, you commented that they all would run underneath the decoy. So I'm sure that there are times where you just have a singleton and that's it. But yes. If you get a singleton in, but you have others about the same size, do you do a quarantine period before you pop them together, or not so much because they're so young, or?
Yeah. So we don't, and this is pretending that HPAI is not around, by the way. So yes, we're going to pretend like that's not a thing, even though it is. And that kind of created a lot of issues, of course, for all of us. Mm-hmm. Yes, they should be together for a couple of reasons. One, they can, you know, bond with each other and learn from each other. But it's just better for the bird to be, because they're flock oriented birds, so it's better to have them together. So you can mix them depending on the ages and sizes. And every year is different. Every bird's different. So sometimes you can put a 2 week old bird with a 1 week old bird, and they're fine. And sometimes you can't, and the 2 week old one is picking on the younger one. And sometimes you have the same age birds picking on each other, because, as you know, in Canada geese, it is natural to have a pecking order. That's part of the mm-hmm. being a goose. They peck at each other, and they chase each other, and, you know, one bird will chase another bird, and that bird will chase another bird, and it's just part of their natural history. That's part of their natural behavior. So that does happen with the gosling still, but they're in an enclosure where they can't get away. And that can cause a lot of problems if you're not paying attention. Okay. So, typically when you put them together, you'll know right away if it's going to work out, because they'll head nod each other, say, hey, what's going on? And then there's no pecking or biting right away. You're usually going to be pretty good. But okay. I always tell people to keep an eye on them for a while. I have my interns watching them, or volunteers, or even our staff, and just making sure that they're getting along for, you know, a few minutes before we walk away, because we don't want to have situations right. happen where they can kill each other.
Right. So you've got mirrors, you've got a decoy in there for them. What's the flooring like?
So it depends on the situation. And right now we are actually in the plans to renovate our wildlife gardens here at the center. And we are installing three new waterfowl ponds, and I am so excited. I cannot wait for this. I think about every day, all day. So that's a best case scenario. But typically we have a water source they can get in and out of that's shallow. We use daisy mat or floor matting on the ground there, you know, for the feet and stuff. I started using hammocks that are made from a that's basically like sport netting, and we can stretch this over a PVC square structure or frame, and it makes it where it's soft. The birds can sit on it. They poop through it. It doesn't get on their feathers, and that's much better for their care, because they poop a lot, obviously. And so
they do.
You know, that's one thing that we can get into in captivity with water birds, where they get fecal, I don't know what you call it, but there's basically burns from the the fecals on their feathers that can actually ruin their down and their feathers and cause waterproofing issues. And that's honestly the one main issue we have currently with geese that are here too long, is that they start getting that, because they're, even though we hose a couple times a day, it's still not enough. So the reason why we're building these new ponds is that way they have more time to swim. It's more of a natural walk into a pond instead of crawling up into something that's not natural. Mm-hmm. And it's just going to be much better. But typically the floor has got the matting on it. It's got a heat lamp to keep the temperature warm, so they can sit there like they would be under mom and dad under their wings. And, you know, we have a food bowl or a food hopper or water hopper, depending. And that's kind of how it's set up. Another thing that's important to have for young Canada geese is somewhere to graze. So we'll get like little piece of sod that we dig out of the back of our property here. And we put
should
that in
we record
bowl.
That or not record that? Should I take that out of the recording just in case?
No,
your
that's
maintenance
good.
people?
Yeah, well,
like, wait, that's why those pieces of sod are gone.
So yeah, we take it from non-discreet places where people are going to trip and fall. But sure. So that's because they're grazers, like we talked before. So even though they'll eat the waterfowl food out of the bowl, it's more natural and it's better for them to have that grazing behavior to do, because, you know, you'll see them graze on the mats in there, and then if they pull too hard enough, that maybe they're ripping pieces off, and that's not good. So it's always good to have, in any of these species we use that we care for, natural foods is the best. So we give them a lot of grass like that way. And one thing that I've learned over the past, you don't want to do, is you want to use the sod pieces, because they can pull it and eat it as it goes. If you rip pieces up with your hands or like a lawnmower and throw it in there, it's really hard to hose out of there in the enclosure. It gets stuck in the mats, it gets stuck in the drain, and it's a real pain to clean. So I have, you know, when we get older goslings, which I'll talk about here soon, I do rip grass. We go out and pick grass, like we did, like pick clover for the cottontails and stuff. We'll pick just, you know, grass, and I put that in a not a bowl, but like a little Tupperware container that the birds could reach in and eat, but they're not getting it on the floor as much, and it's less, it's easier to clean that way. So we do that for the larger birds, but the youngsters, the newly hatched guys, we do just pieces of sod. They just graze on that, and that works good.
Well, that just stimulates their natural behavior, which reduces stress and gets them more nutrition and all that stuff. Yep. What are you feeding?
So we actually changed our diets last year. We've always used Missouri waterfowl foods and Missouri just in general here at the center. But we were using Missouri waterfowl starter, and they were growing too fast. And sometimes you have to keep these birds longer. One main reason is we'll get some from the public and they're too friendly. So I keep them longer with the wild ones, so they stay longer. So they're here for a week or two, depending to try to get them wild up again. And so you keep them longer than you'd like. So we were using Missouri waterfowl, and then they were getting angel wing, even at, you know, three weeks old. And so we can fix that if you catch it early enough, but it's still, why is that happening? And so I started researching and talking to other waterfowl experts, and that Missouri waterfowl starter has a ton of protein in it. And, you know, ducklings need that protein. They're eating a ton of insects, or mostly insects when they're growing. But the geese are eating, you know, more grains and vegetation, so there's less protein in that. So they were growing too fast, and that's, you know, why we don't recommend feeding bread and all those other things, because it's just not a good – their body kind of grows too fast for it, and their wing droops. And what angel wing for – you want to talk about angel wing real quick?
Maybe just very briefly, yeah.
Yeah, just basically the wing is growing, and the blood feathers are heavy, and it pulls down – and flips the wing flips backwards, and so it grows that way. So it's not an injury. It just the bones are healing, or not healing, growing backwards. And so once the bones are all healed, or once the bones are all formed, it's no going back. So, but if it's early, within the part where the wings are still soft, you can fix that angel wing. So we actually switched last year to using Missouri Waterfowl Maintenance and blending it up in a blender, so it's small pieces, so it's kind of a powder or smaller pieces in place of the Missouri starter. And so that seemed to help, but we still, that was kind of late in the season where we figured that out. So we're going to try that new this spring and see if that's going to have a better outcome. And so that's what we feed them.
Okay. Yeah. And then you're supplementing with lots of greens and, and things like that too. Yep. So, I wanted to ask you, when I saw your talk in Ohio, you were talking about the Peck-matic.
Yes.
Can you explain what that is?
So Peck-matic, I learned this from a center in Louisiana. It's a real thing. Like, I thought he was joking at first, but it's a little feeder that's made for like chickens and domestic poultry, where it's a bucket that hangs from somewhere, and there's a little funnel in there, and there's a little rod that's through the funnel. Like, kind of picture your funnel when you're putting oil in your car, and you know, they got the funnel in there. And so it's the same principle, except it's a little bit bigger, and there's a metal rod that's shaped like a T that's in there. And so you can fill that with their food, and they'll peck at it, and then the food falls down onto the ground or into the water, ideally for the water species, and they eat it. And so that way there's no food in a bowl. It's all in, it all falls as they're pecking at it. So you're not getting a lot of waste. You're not getting mold. You're not getting all these other issues. And this is probably going to work better for water birds that are in strictly water, like where geese are, you know, they're feeding out of the water more so than the ducks are, of course. So, but it's really interesting. And so we're going to start using that this year, hopefully. And then definitely when we get our new ponds to prevent, you know, all the bowls of food we have to put out there that get wet or rain gets on them or something. It's going to be a much easier option. So it's really cool. They just peck at it curiosity wise, and then the food falls, they eat it, and then they peck out the food falls, they eat it, and then that's it. So we're gonna see how that works this coming year.
I love it. Yeah. Oh, we're gonna check back. You know that. I'm gonna say, send me some pictures so I can put it up for everybody to see what Peck-O-Matic is. It's a brilliant idea. Whoever came up with it, props to them. Okay, so let's get into really why I wanted to talk to you is about how in the world do you foster Canada geese goslings?
So this is, I'm so glad that we're talking about this, because it's definitely one thing that a lot of centers have trouble with. And I've even talked to some centers that just raise their geese because it's never worked. That's one thing I hear often. Well, I tried it once and it didn't work. I'm like, what did you do? You know, if it didn't work, you did something wrong. What did you do wrong? How can you improve? How can you fix that? Why did it go wrong? And I've went through all those scenarios to get to where we're at now. I've learned, like we were talking before, we used to just use a box and then pick them up and set them on the floor. Then we started using kennels. Then we started doing other things. And so typically when we get an orphan gosling and say it's releasable, it's waterproof, it's not injured, it's ready to go, I will previously have checked the whole local areas of where there's geese and finding babies of the same size. So that's one crucial thing you need to know when you're fostering geese very young, specifically under a week old, is you have to foster them to a pair or pairs that have the exact same size babies. That's very crucial because they know it's not their bird. And if you have a pair that's very specific, like that one I was telling you about at Tri-C and Parma in the 90s, that if they're not the same size, they're going to know and they're going to pick on that baby. So I've had that happen where you have a pair that is not accepting this new gosling because it's a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller, and they know it's not their baby. So, you know, they have to have the same exact size the earlier, the younger they are. So when they're real green and tiny, you know, they're really, they get that real dark green hue to their back and the top of their head. They're, you know, they're 1, 2, 3, 4 days old under a week. And so they're real little, they're real small, and they're not real mobile at that point too. They can walk, but they're not like in a rush to the pond when a predator comes. And so that's one other reason why when you're trying to foster, the younger they are, the more closer the parents are going to be to the water than they would be as they're bigger. So as the babies age, they travel like all over the place. But that's they're already their muscles are built up, their stamina is built up, and so they can walk or run quickly for a pretty good distance. But when they're little, they don't have that option because they're just not big enough. Sure. So they're going to be closer to water. So you'll see the, you know, within a week or two, or a week of age, that pair that you're going to foster to is going to be right near that water source, typically.
Okay.
Within the edge of the water, maybe a little bit, you know, a few yards up away, but they're going to be close to that pond because that water source is safety to them. Mm-hmm. And the babies can't run that fast. So even though you have the parents protecting them, the parents know what's safe and what's not. So mm-hmm. you want to have the same size babies. So you get a young gosling that you know, it's deemed releasable. It's waterproof. It's not injured. It's scared of people. You take that bird in a kennel. And so we'll talk about single birds and then we'll talk about groups of birds you have. Okay.
Perfect.
So we're going to, because that's different too. So if you're fostering one baby to a group of group of geese, either one flock or two flocks or whatever, you get as close you can to that family. Set the kennel on the ground, open it up, you know, flip the towel up off the door and just back up and get out of there. The second you open that towel, they're going to be peeping and peeping and peeping. That gander is going to run over and you're going to want to watch his behavior, their behavior. So head pumping is where their head is kind of at an upright position and they pump it up and down. So the head stays vertical with the ground or horizontal with the ground rather, but the neck is going vertical. It's going up and down. And that's kind of like, hey, come here. Hey, we're good. This is good. And if you have the head pumping, then the baby will run over to the new baby or to their, you know, the foster babies. Well, the foster baby will run over to the wild babies. And then the parents, you have to watch the parents and the babies. So the babies may pick on each other and the new baby. So you have to watch for that. But then you also have to watch for the behavior of the parents. Because I've had it happen where the gander accepts them, but the goose doesn't. The female goose is not into it.
Wow.
Or vice versa. So you have to watch that head pumping back and forth. So once you let that bird go and it runs to that group, the head pumping should happen. And then also they'll flip their head like when they're going to fly, you can see their head will kind of flip in the air. They'll kind of flip it in like a circular motion. That means that they want to move, either fly or walk or swim. So that means the parents are like, okay, hey, you're cool. You're one of my babies. Let's get out of here because this person just caused an issue for us. There's a human there, so let's get away from that issue. And I've learned that these birds are smart. And so throughout the summer, even without the first few weeks, those birds know my car. And they know the second I pull up, their heads go up, they start doing alarm barks, and they're all running to the water or getting to the water before I can even get to them. And so,
what are you doing to those poor birds, your favorite birds? Just, and they are running away from you.
Giving them kids, but they don't know I'm not causing an issue. So they just, you know, because it's scary for them. So if everything works out okay, the babies will head nod each other, the parents will head nod the baby will head nod the parents, and then they all go back to feeding. And it worked out. But I've had situations happen where that does work. But then a few minutes later, you notice the baby's not waterproof. And they know that that's not their baby. And then they start picking at it. And so I always encourage people and really, really demand people. Once you foster these babies, you stick around for a little while, make sure it works okay. Because if it doesn't, they're gonna separate and get you know, kind of kicked away from that foster family, and then you have to go get them again, which can also be tricky.
Right, so, especially if they're really close to the water, and then you can't get it. Yeah.
Well, so the baby doesn't know the water safety yet. You know, they didn't learn that yet. So,
okay.
So typically, they'll walk away from the water. They'll walk up, you know, walk away into the woods or something.
Okay.
And I've had that happen last summer, where I fostered two babies to a group, and it looked okay, but they weren't waterproof, and the parents knew, and then they kind of picked at them, and then they went into the woods. I had to go retrieve them out of this thicket. So crucially, the main thing we want to take away from fostering, I just want to reiterate this as we're going, is making sure they're waterproof. That's one thing that they have to be fully waterproof, because if they're not, the parents are going to know they're not their babies. So if the same size, they all look similar, it's fine. But if they're wet, it's not going to work in most cases, unless you have a pair that you foster away from water, which does happen, and they have time to preen and clean their feathers before they get to the pond. And at that point, then they're already with the parents for a while. And then the parents will just be going, why are you wet? What's going on? Like, you know, they'll wait up for them. But if it's at the fostering attempt,
okay,
you got to be careful.
Okay. So that's so yeah, if it doesn't work, you need to gather that gosling up. And it's usually because, well, could be a lot of reasons, but one of them for sure might be that they're not waterproof.
Yes. So that's one main rejection reason we've found in the past, is they're not fully waterproof. And so that's very crucial. And I actually had one years ago that they appeared waterproof at first. And the parents took them on. They were happy to take them, but then once they noticed they weren't waterproof, the parents instantly rejected them. So the foster parents.
That is so interesting.
It is. So with any bird, you want to make sure the waterproof. Sometimes it's trickier with, you know, the geese, because they're not jumping in the water as much as the mallards are or the wood ducks are. So, but you have, that's why you have to give them enough water to swim in, where they can swim and preen and bathe, and really make sure they're waterproof before you get them out, because that's okay. Crucial.
Okay.
You know, okay. Yeah. So, and another thing to note is if you get an orphan gosling in and it looks okay, get it fostered immediately. Like if you can get out and just leave it after that intake, which is not always possible, of course, right. But just get out and take that bird right to another family that can take it. Cause then it's not used to people. It's waterproof. Everything's normal. All you have to do is drop it off and it runs with the family and it works out perfect. So that's an ideal scenario. That doesn't always work, because you know how busy we can get.
Right, but that just speaks to kind of knowing your area and knowing where the geese are, and you know, maybe enlisting other people too to at least get the first, you know, whether it's bird watchers or whatever. So they may not know the intricacies, but at least if you know where to look,
yes,
then you have a chance.
Yep, and one thing that I do, I will do on the social media, there's a lot of birding groups in every state, and I will post on there, hey, I have this baby animal, I want to foster it. Is anyone willing to, or does anyone have these babies at their property that I can foster to? And I've actually fostered a lot of owls that way, because, I have a barred owl pair in my backyard, and they have these babies. And so it works out great. So that's another way. It's just like, hey, I have young geese, you could post a photo, they're this age, and then people say, oh yeah, there's a pond at my place, can bring them on over. And so it's great to just get the word out that way.
Okay, excellent. Okay, so gosling's under a week old, whether you're doing one or does, so you've kind of described how you put one with the foster family. If you are doing multiple with a particular foster family, is it about the same technique?
It is the same, but you don't want to do too many at one time. And I've learned that can cause rejection, because then that, you know, so it coming from the goose, the parents, you know, the foster parents standpoint, one of my babies just got lost and here he's coming back and we're good. And why is this human near this baby? That's what they're thinking. But if you have a big group of babies running up to another group, they're going to think, well, where are the parents at? These aren't my kids. And they're more likely to reject them versus accepting them. So I've tried to release like six or seven at a time. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. It does work in an ideal situation, which would be a multiple family unit at a pond, different age babies. So you'll have, you know, like I was telling you before, I think I mentioned it, that the geese are going to stay away from other birds, other flocks, when those babies are really, really, really young.
Right.
But as they get older, they start to go back into their natural, their flocks again. And you'll have parents mixing with other parents and other babies. And that's just kind of an evolutionary. The more the numbers, the safer they're going to be, the more eyes there are for predators, and it works out. So they do go back into those big groups again as they get older, but it's not really until probably 2 to 3 weeks old.
Okay.
Until they really start mixing with other groups. And they will mix depending on the, you know, you might have a pond that has a really welcoming pair. At our release location, we had one male, we called him Speckle Belly, because he had a lot of black spots up his chest, which isn't really normal. He was so inviting and accepting of any baby, any size, doesn't matter. He'd accept it and he'd protect it and it would work out every time. He was hit by a car and killed.
Of course.
And
of course.
The dynamics have changed dramatically at that flock since that bird passed away, which is really unfortunate. But it just got to watch their behavior. So I will do probably two babies at a time or three, depending on how many they have. So if you say it's a perfect scenario and you have four pairs and each of them have 5 to 7 babies, you can release one kennel of birds, you know, let one or two out, foster them, wait a minute, take the other kennel out, do the same thing. And this is assuming you get close to them at this point.
Okay.
But you foster them. You let the you open the kennel out. You let them run out to the group. Wait a minute. Do it again. And so it'll work. And these are assuming they're all the same size. But if they're not the same size, as long as you have mixed sizes in the groups that are around, it'll still work usually.
Okay.
Because they're going to mix together. You know, there's actually parents that'll steal babies from other pairs. I've actually seen that myself where in my talk that I did that you saw, there was a photo of a pair of Canada geese and there was like 50 some babies with that pair.
Right, right.
They will actually physically steal other babies from other parents. And that's just a thing they do. And so the more babies you have in a flock, the better chance it is of it working. So, you know, like I said, as you get to that 2-3 week old period, it's going to be easier because they're going to be more likely to be together and it's going to be easier to foster that way. But you still got to watch. You still got to make sure they're getting along, because I had one situation where they would have been ideal size, age, and they were rejected. It was the year that bird died. And so it was really weird. I was like, I don't know why this isn't working.
Right.
But it just didn't work. And so I had to catch them back up and then we were able to foster them later on. But one thing also too, I want to reiterate, make sure you have permission to foster.
Yes.
There's a lot of people that don't like geese and there's a lot of people that don't want geese in their property. And so always make sure you get permission. It's favorable to have private property places to foster, because that way you have permission there. You can have some permission from certain parks and city parks and state parks, but most of those places are going to say, oh, we have too many geese. We don't need any more. So always get permission, because you don't want to get yourself in trouble for, you know, dumping birds in a park. And then you have to get yelled at or in trouble for releasing birds illegally.
Right.
So you always get permission first. That's one thing I forgot to mention that we want to reiterate, is make sure you're allowed to do that before you do this.
Mm-hmm. So that does speak to the preparation, right?
Yeah.
It speaks to knowing where the geese are that show up in your area. And, you know, you've got your social media, you've got your birding groups, and, you know, you might be able to do some pre-permission stuff. Do you have any particular tips for getting permission? I mean, it's just you knocking on the door and, hey, I got this gosling and I'd like to release it. Or is it, I'm going to try to talk to you outside of the season, or I'm going to just, people I meet in the grocery store, or my friends of friends, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, how do you do it?
Yeah, there's many different ways. You know, there's ways of just talking to the park managers. You know, say there's one place we release in a park here locally, and so I just birding there, I just talk to the park managers and stuff, and I say, hey, gonna be getting baby geese here soon, is it okay if I bring a few out? And they'll be, oh yeah, sure, no problem. So every situation different. So just, you know, just kind of talking to them, telling them what you do. Say, hey, I work at the center, you know, we want the best for our wildlife and it's better to foster them. You know, if you're okay with it, we'll just do a couple or whatever, and then it just works out there. But I found that it's, you have much more success with doing it at private residences with people that love the geese, don't want them on your, they don't mind them on the property. They love them there. They encourage them to be there. And actually just met a woman last week from a goose that she brought in that was hit by a car. And just from talking to her, I knew she was a goose nerd like we are. And so I'm like, you know, hey, we're always looking for, you know, places to foster, you know, would you be willing to do it? She said, well, yeah, sure. You can bring them over. And so, so that's another way, is when someone brings you a bird, you know, say, can you, where did this come from? You know, can we release it back there? Or sometimes I will call, if I know it came from a specific location, I will call that location, say, hey, you know, I know that, you know, that this goose came from your property, you know, can we bring it back to its family once it's ready to go? And usually they say yes, but sometimes they don't. And then you have to foster them somewhere else. So just talking to people, just being friendly about it and just saying, hey, you know, this is, they're only here temporarily. They're not going to stay the whole time. You know, can we try? And, you know, it's every situation different. Every city's different. So just be nice as you can. If they say no, say, thank you very much. No problem. We'll find somewhere else, you know, and just keep trying.
Right. Right. Yeah. Great. Great advice.
But I know one thing that I wanted to mention too is the older the birds, the harder they are to pinpoint where they're at. So when they first hatch, they're typically going to be at one pond. They're going to be there every single day, all day. But as they get older, waterfowl molt, really interestingly different than other birds like raptors.
Oh,
do.
Yeah, so, I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
This is important.
So if you notice in June and July, most waterfowl are not flying around above your heads like they normally are, and they're always walking across the road. You think, oh, these geese are stupid. Why are they walking across the road? It's because they can't fly. They're such heavy-bodied birds that they probably wouldn't be able to fly easily if they molted similar to, you know, say red-tailed hawk, where their first year, all the wing feathers will stay the same, and then the following year in like March, they might drop one of their primaries and then one of their secondaries, and as those are growing back or half in, another mm-hmm. primary falls out, and then that's how you can age some of these birds. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're working with banding or things like that, you can age these birds and know how old they are by the molt pattern. But with waterfowl, they drop all their flight feathers at one time, so they're fully flightless. So usually in June or July, they're fully flightless, so they're walking around. And so I'll drive to work and go past the pond and check in the morning and say, okay, there's, you know, four pairs of birds here, a bunch of babies. And I go mm-hmm. back at noon and there's not one bird to be seen anywhere. It's like, where did they go? Like, there's no pond anywhere, you know, but sure. they're smart. They're little dinosaurs, you know, they really are. And they're at that age where they book it and the parents will move from one pond to another or another water source or another food source. And they can, it's a risk, you know, cause there are predators around, but they're very smart and they usually move pretty quickly. So they can travel long distances when they're flightless. So mm-hmm. that's one thing to note is that when you think they're going to be at one location, they might not be. So, but typically they're going to have a pattern. So if you see birds at this location at 9 a.m. and they're not there at noon, but then they're back at, you know, 8 p.m., go on the times you're seeing them there, because you're gonna have more likely of a chance to run into them, because they have a pretty good pattern going. They're pretty patternistic.
Very consistent that way. So that's good. Yeah. I mean, that's good. That gives you a clue on because otherwise it's like, yo, you're right. Where? I've always thought too that maybe I read this someplace that, of course, during the summer they're going to molt because there's more resources available. Mm-hmm. And of course, ducks and geese can molt all those flight feathers because their food is right in front of them.
Right.
They may have to walk to it, but they can. It's right there. Where a raptor is dependent on flight to catch whatever they're going to eat. Right.
That's a good
point. So they need to be able to fly through the molt. But it also almost, you know, Canada geese, as we've been discussing, are great parents, and they probably stick around anyway. But the fact that they cannot fly, maybe keeps them closer to those goslings regardless during parts of the time where it's pretty tenuous for those goslings. They're much more at risk. So yes, you've got a coupling of the adults are incredible, you know, they're pair bonded and they're a lot invested in those goslings, but also, they can't fly. So I'm going to wing slap you if you come near me.
And you brought up a good point, and that's, I forgot to mention that. And thank you for saying that. Typically the parents are going to molt their flight feathers once their babies are about 4 weeks old, because then once the babies are fully flighted, the parents are flighted the exact same time. So it works out. What I've learned though, interestingly with mallards, is that's not the case. With ducks, they don't molt until the babies are flighted already. And I never knew this until we started, we have a banding project here where we band Canada geese, mallards, wood ducks, and hooded mergansers. And we can, I go to our release location often and do an assessment. I have a little data tracking sheet. I write down like, okay, I saw this bird this time of day. And and I noted that this one hen, I was like, when is she going to molt? When is she going to molt? She didn't molt. It was for the babies were 4 weeks old, 5 weeks old, 6 weeks old, 7, 8 weeks old. And then she disappeared and she was gone for exactly 4 weeks, then came back. So that taught me, and I didn't know this. I'm a big waterfowl nerd. I had no idea that these ducks molt after their babies are flighted. And I think the reason why, like you said, they have all the food there, but there's only one parent with ducks. And so they're going to be more likely to lose a clutch or lose their brood early on versus geese. So like as all of us that take in mallards or ducklings of any species, usually get them in April, May, June, and July.
Right.
A month later, we get about four different rounds of them every year, where typically you get geese really about once. You might get a later clutch, but typically you're going to get most of your geese within end of April, beginning of May, or through May, and then that's about it. And so you don't get goslings really later on. Is that because that they're more successful than the ducks are? And so just evolution worked out with these birds. Mm-hmm. And so the ducks molt after the babies are already flooded, because if they lost that clutch early, they can re-nest, they can rebreed, they can re-clutch, you know, double clutch, triple clutch, quadruple clutch, or whatever, and they can still fly to their and do their thing. But when they're flightless, they're restricted to where they're at.
They're really restricted.
So that's one thing I forgot to note. And so that's really interesting learning about these birds, is that they're the ducks and geese are very different. But that's kind of a side note with the ducks. But it's really interesting.
Here's another natural history question with geese, since we're talking about molting and then flying at the, you know, so the goslings now are old enough, you know, end of the summer, into the fall, where they're starting to fly. They're still with their parents. How long do they stay with their parents?
That's a good question. And I don't know if I know fully how long, but they would stay with them throughout that winter and then into early spring. And then once they are, the pairs are becoming territorial and want to nest again, they'll kind of shun those youngsters off, and those birds go into non-breeding groups, and they do a reverse molt migration. So instead of flying south, they'll fly north, molt up there, then they come south. And I learned that from band data that we had from birds that were shot by hunters, where I'm like, why are they all the way up there now? And it's because they leave and molt somewhere else and in these non-breeding groups. And so, like I was saying before, the geese aren't going to typically nest until they're into their second year. So, so birds that were hatched in 2022 were now going to be nesting in this coming year.
This coming year. Okay.
So, it's really interesting stuff.
Oh, that's cool. How long do they live in the wild? Man, I know it's all approximate, but
it's approximate, but one of the oldest known birds was a banded bird that was from Ohio actually. And it was around 30 years old.
Wow.
So it depends, but on average, you know, in a place that's not hunted or local parks, they can live in their 20s, no problem. It's wow. Between 20 and 30 is an average age for a Canada goose in the wild.
Wow, that's amazing. Gosh, we've talked about so many different things. That's so amazing. Pro tips. What are some of your pro tips?
So pro tips for fostering specifically is making sure the birds are waterproof, that they're scared of you. That you're going to foster them as quick as you can when you get them in. Because we'll get babies that are, you know, often around 4 weeks old, they're hit by cars because that's when they're traveling a lot. Mm-hmm. Or they have broken wings from dogs getting them, things like that, fishing line injuries. And so that's easier because that's just a rehab and get them back to where they came from. Or get them back to a flock of the same size babies. It's much easier as they get older. So that's one thing to take away. It's less work to foster them the older they are. It's more tricky, and there's more things you have to pay attention to the younger they are. Mm-hmm. So the younger they are, the quicker you want to get them to that foster family, the more they have to be the exact same size to the foster parents and the foster kids with your foster baby.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to just watch them after you let them go. You have to watch to make sure it's working out. Typically, you'll have more success with multiple family unit ponds. So you might have one pair over here and another pair over here, another pair over here. And as long as there's a multiple pairs, you should still be okay. Because if it doesn't work with one pair, and I've had this happen where you foster babies and everything works out, but the parents aren't really liking it, or the gander is not okay with it, or the goose is not okay with it, and they get kind of picked at a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'll wait a minute just to make sure, because there might be a little bit picking and that's okay. And if there's too much picking, they might walk and leave. Those babies are going to go away and they're going to walk to that other flock. And sometimes it works perfectly, but you have to watch after you let them go, because you have to make sure that it's working out, because sometimes it doesn't. Sure. And it might take a few minutes. Usually you're going to know right away. Within the first 5 minutes, you're going to know if it's going to be successful or not. And I will often go back and check at the end of the day, just to confirm. So I'll say, okay, these birds have 5 babies. We gave them 2. They're now going to have 7. I'll go back and check. And okay, there's 7 babies there. I'll go the next day. Okay, there's still 7. We're good. But typically you're going to know something's not working almost immediately. And two of the main things that are causing that rejection are not being waterproof and being 2 different sized babies. early on. So like I said, the earlier they are, the kind of the better, the more they have to be the same exact size and age. And there's another, I forgot to mention, when they're really, really young, they're not going to be able to keep up with an older pair that has older babies.
Right.
So they're going to be less strong. They're not going to have as much muscle mass. They're going to be less likely to keep up with that older group. And these geese know that. They're, like I said, they're smart. And I've mentioned this many times about why I love these birds. They're incredibly intelligent. I could be watching a pond, watching the geese, you know, looking for bands or what, just watching them. And you hear, and it's like a little low, growly. And I look up and I say, where's the dog? I look around. There's a dog like 2 miles down the road coming towards the pond. It's an alarm bark. So they're very, very intelligent. So they know, they're just always watching their surroundings. So you just got to watch their behavior when you do this fostering. If the parents are doing any head down motions, that's not usually good. If they're doing like a head nodding, that's perfect. Or the head pumps, that's perfect. But if their head's down along the ground or on top of the water flat, that's not good unless they're flipping their head. So they'll put their head in the, a parents will talk to each other and they'll honk and honk and honk and, hey, we're all good. And their head is low, but their head is up and it's circling and it's, and it, and they're vocalizing. That's good. That's a good sign. Mm-hmm. But if the head is down and it's staying down, that is an aggressive posture. You don't want to, you want to pay attention because that's probably not going to work out.
Okay.
Another thing that I've noted that when I mentioned before, how they fluff their feathers in aggression,
right,
you have to pay attention to what that aggression is towards. So if you foster a baby goose to this pair and you have non-breeders next to you that are a little bit near that pair and they do, you know, the fluff up, is that towards the baby or is that towards that pair, that, that non-breeding flock that's nearby?
Sure.
So you have to know what the aggression is geared towards. Typically, they're going to be looking at that, that source of anger, and they're going to fluff up and head, and they're going to be pointing towards that, that source of what they're upset by. So typically if you're fostering this baby and it's walking directly at this gander and he fluffs directly at that youngster, that's not a good sign. That means that that dad is saying, nope, that you're not mine. Do not come over here. And, you know, wild geese know that, but if it's fairly newly fostered and real young, it may not know that behavior yet. So it's all, this is all instincts kicking in. So that baby doesn't know that yet. So you got to be really careful. So just watch the behavior of those parents. Make sure they're waterproofing. Make sure there's head pumping. There's head nodding. You know, the kind of like, you know, they, hey, what's going on? They're honking and honking. Their heads are going up and down. And then eventually they calm down. They all go into the water. They go into a feeding mode. Typically, that's when you know it worked out. The fostering was successful. If all the yelling and the loud and the honking and something that is over with after this first initial, you know, reintroduction or fostering, really, because once you have that baby, they think it's lost. You know, they think one of their babies got lost. So they're the male start honking and honking and honking, and the baby's, you know, peeping, and then the female's hinking, and then they get together and then they honk and they're all happy as a family. Then they start going to feeding. That's usually means everything worked out, but still just watch it. You really got to watch that behavior and making sure that they're not fighting each other. They're not picking at each other. I've had situations where I foster a young bird and then they're fine, but then their own babies are fighting each other. So, you know, you just kind of got to watch it. And one thing I forgot to mention too, is this is one huge thing I totally forgot to mention. I'm so glad I thought of it. Give them as much space as you can in your center while they're in care with you, because they walk a lot. They're walking a lot when they're in the wild. I've had it happen where you foster a young goose, maybe say it's one day old or 5 days old, and you put it out with this pair. It starts running in circles because it's excited to be free. And it confuses the parents because they don't know what's going on. And then they start kind of backing up and like, whoa, what's happening? Why is this goose acting this way? And then their babies start acting weird. So I've learned too, and I'm so glad I thought of this, that we used to keep them little brooders, and they were small little enclosures to make sure that they're warm and they're safe. But I've actually given them more space now to walk and use their muscles to play in that water, because they're less likely to run in circles like a psycho. and they're happy. They're running around. They're free. But that can be panic to those parents and the other siblings. And so,
yeah, because they're not acting right. The behavior is not right.
Why are they running around like that? Why? What are they doing that for? And we've all seen geese in ponds where they're taking a bath and they're diving in the water. And that's it's fun for them, but it's also a natural defense mechanism is if a predator is nearby, like if an eagle flies over, you know, the geese can actually dive like ducks can. Mm-hmm. And so that's a survival technique. And so whatever it is, it's a very, very stressy thing. And the parents are like, whoa, what's going on? And that can cause, you don't want any confusion with these fostering situations. So,
right.
You know, making sure that bird has a lot of time to walk around, move around, spend time moving around, because they're less likely or almost zero likely chance to run around like a crazy kid, you know, on recess. if you had enough, you know, space for them in captivity.
Oh my gosh. Well, I think that anybody listening to this, if they weren't fans of Canada geese before, they are now. So thank you, Tim. That was
it's amazing. And one thing to add is geese know their own families and their mates and their family units. Mm-hmm. I have released birds back to their family. So I just actually caught a goose on my birthday that was wrapped in fishing line, and I caught her, brought her to work, removed the line. She wasn't able to walk on that foot, and we fixed her up, let her go. To let her go, we took her back to the same pond she came from, and she, you know, walked out of the kennel, kind of looked around, did a couple barks, and there were two birds in the water when I released her, and there were actually only three birds at that pond when I rescued her too.
Okay.
And so those two birds in the water, and they were kind of swimming away, and she kind of did a little bit of a low bark, and the male in the water turned and barked a little bit. She barked again. Then he started honking. She started hinking. She flew into the water. He swam over to her, and they were doing their head in the water down and honking and talking to each other. And it was like, hey, where you been? I'm so glad to see you. And if you haven't witnessed that in this situation, you have to see it. It's just, it's so much fun to watch that reuniting of that pair. Really shows how much they love each other, how good of a parents they are, how caring they are in their family flock. It's so much fun, and you really got to get out and watch geese. I know that they poop a lot, and you know they can be mean, but really they're good parents, and you just got to watch.
You're right; it's not being mean; it's being defensive for themselves or for the goslings, or you got to look at the context, you know.
Yes.
And we would do the same thing. We wouldn't. Your example at the beginning was amazing. You know, it's like we would do the same thing if somebody was threatening one of our kids.
Right.
We would expect it, right?
Right.
We wouldn't call it mean. You know, we'd be called protective and good parents. So,
yes.
Oh my gosh, Tim, this was amazing to be able to spend this amount of time talking about one of our favorite birds. So thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And again, a shout out to the Ohio Wildlife Rehab Association. That conference again was amazing, and got to meet a lot of new people, and you know, got to visit with people that I've known for a little while now. So new friends and old friends and things like that. And of course, this talk on fostering Canada geese. So.
Yeah. Please reach out to us if you have questions. We'd be happy to answer those. This is what, you know, conferences and these podcasts are all about, is they're trying to help other rehabilitators with success with these species that may not have success with. You know, I've had so many people, like I mentioned in the beginning, that are, oh, I don't foster because it's too hard. It doesn't work. It's like, well, it does work. There's just different things you have to do to make it successful. And so that's why this podcast is great. It's the only one that I know of that's out there that really is dedicated to rehabilitation and helping other rehabilitators. So this is awesome. And I'm so honored to be on this podcast
with you
because I've listened to all of the other ones, and they're all amazing. All the other speakers on there are just, it's so engaging and it's so great. And so I'm honored to be a part of this again. And, I hope that the audience learned something from this podcast that we're doing about this incredible species and just maybe more of an appreciation for this incredible bird.
So thank you very much again, Tim.
Absolutely. I'm happy to be here, and I love this, and this is great. So thank you so much for having me.
That was Tim Jasinski, Wildlife Rehabilitation Specialist at Lake Erie Nature and Science Center in Bay Village, Ohio. I hope you enjoyed our discussion on fostering Canada geese. Next episode, I talk with Ruby Davis, Wildlife Rehabilitation Director of the Carolina Wildlife Conservation Center in North Carolina. It's a topic I must admit I don't know as much about, and that's skunks. But we get to talk about skunks' natural history, including mating season, and how a young skunk kit's path to independence also happens. We also cover common illnesses in skunks and a lot more. And I'm going to go for the dumb joke now and say, don't be a stinker and miss this episode. Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release is a production of Partners for Wildlife, working hand in hand with wildlife rehabilitators and veterinarians to improve the welfare of orphaned, ill, and injured wildlife. Our executive producer is me, Gail Buell. I'm the partnership coordinator for Partners for Wildlife at the University of Minnesota, College of Veterinary Medicine's Raptor Center. To learn more about the Raptor Center and Partners for Wildlife, visit raptor.umn.edu. Our producer is Kirk Klocky. Special thanks to our guest Tim Jasinski, Partners for Wildlife, and the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. And that's our show. Hope you'll join us again next time.